Okay, let's get started. Right in time. We have quite a bit to cover, and I hope we get through it all. So for those who came in late and those who don't know me, my name is Bharat Suneja. I am senior technical writer in the Exchange UA team. I'm responsible for security and compliance, including archiving, retention, journaling. You probably use journaling to feed your archives. So all those features, fun stuff. Compliance is a very fun subject for me, and I hope it is for all those Exchange people who are trying to get these things done. So some of the biggest challenges for us as Exchange folks, mailboxes keep on growing larger, and it all started when somebody said, oh, 2 gigs is a good mailbox size. And then it was unlimited mailbox. And it started from consumer email, and it spilled into enterprise email, where users come in expecting never having to delete email. And we came in with the mindset of storage is expensive, and I need to impose quotas on my user, so they only store X amount of email. And that's been changing. So this allows you, archiving allows you to manage your storage, the ever-growing needs of storage. Reducing the proliferation of PSTs. We all love PSTs, and we can't wait to see them go. Network performance, it has some little bit bearing on pulling down really large mail, either in a PST or on your Exchange server, pulling it down to the client. Then there is data retention requirements. These are different for different industries, companies in different segments, in different geographical locations. They have different requirements how long they should retain their data for. And that is feeding this ever-growing need of having to store more and more email in our mailbox servers or archiving systems. Finally, what do we do? Why do we need to retain all this email is, of course, e-discovery. When you get that request, or order rather, to perform an e-discovery, you're going to have to produce that email. And it's no good if it's scattered in PST files all across your users' desktops and laptops and home computers and God knows where. Because with PSTs, it's really easy to do that, right? They create a PST, they dump all their data, copy all their data into a PST, and now it's out of your control. You cannot apply any policies to it. E-discovery is going to be prohibitively expensive unless you have archiving in place. So what did we do before Exchange 2010? We used journaling to feed journaling mailboxes or in-house on-premises archiving systems, which sucked email out of one database, which is Exchange, and put it in another database. So now you could store it for X amount of time. And it gave you capabilities to do discovery and so on. Now, the journaling agent is what does the journaling. It runs on a hub transport server. It catches every email, but email, that means it has to go through the transport. There are items that do not go through the transport. For instance, your contact objects, your appointments, your drafts that you create and save it on your computer, none of that goes to the transport server. None of that gets journaled. So let me pull up a little comparison, this video that we just came out with on my laptop. And that gives you a little bit of a...
Paul is responsible for his company's email archiving system. They used to archive email using journaling, which stores messages in a special external mailbox. When Paul joined the company, journaling to a third party was pretty much the only choice. But it had problems. The process of getting messages into the external mailbox can alter them and even open them up to intentional tampering. That made Paul a bit nervous. To comply with discovery requests, Paul might have to reconcile his journaled archive with his Exchange data. In other words, he would have to search both mailboxes no easy matter if you're talking about millions of messages. Also, journaling only captures email and meeting requests. Other calendar items don't get archived, nor do tasks and contacts, all of which can be important for discovery requests. Paul could use a third-party add-on to capture that data, but he'd have to manage it separately, and it might get in the way of future Exchange upgrades. For all those reasons, Paul replaced journaling with in-place archiving. It's built into Exchange. No third-party software or separate archives are required. Messages are preserved exactly as they were when the user last sent, received, or edited them, including metadata. Exchange can archive all the items in a user's inbox, so everything is discoverable, not just email. It even preserves folder structure. Best of all for Paul, with in-place archiving, he only has one system to manage. He trusts Exchange with mission-critical email, and now he can use the same system for archiving.
So that was a little intro, no applause. Thought that was a pretty well done video. Okay, so that's the story with journaling. That's what we've been doing before Exchange 2010. When Exchange 2010 came out, we introduced in-place journaling. I'm sorry, in-place archiving. And instead of feeding these journal reports that are basically email metadata with recipient information expanded, distribution lists, and so on, and the email message attached to it, and feeding it to another archive, we now try to store it in place within Exchange 2010. Now, at Exchange 2010, when we released it, at RTM, we had on-premises archives, or what were called personal archives. That means both the primary mailbox and the secondary mailbox is on your Exchange 2010 on-premises server. What's the benefit of this? We just saw, you know, you don't need any Outlook plugins, first of all. Because a lot of these archives, the systems leave stubs in the mailbox. Now, users can access the archived email by clicking on the stub in Outlook. It appears like an email. But when you click on them, it goes and fetches that email from the archive and renders it to you, but you need an Outlook plugin. So there's deployment costs for that. There is costs for deploying third-party archiving systems and the storage that goes along with that. In a lot of cases, you're just replicating email also, thereby increasing your storage cost. With in-place archiving, you're using Exchange. The same system where you're trusting it to store all your email is also becoming a long-term storage space for your archived email. There is no third-party client-side plugins or software to deploy. There is no extra IT tools to learn, and the added complexity. It makes it much simpler. The end-user experience is much better because it's native Exchange and Outlook web app also. So keeping things very, very simple, how does it look like to the user? It's like a PST file, except it's online. So they don't have to roam around computer to computer copying their PST files. It's always available. They fire up Outlook, it's there, as long as they're online. They fire up Outlook web app, it's there. PSTs don't do that. So it's a great experience for users. It's online only access from Outlook and Outlook web app. How does email move to the archive? There is archive policies, which you can configure by default. It'll move all the email within 2 years from the date it's received. How does it look like for the administrator? It's pretty much like an additional mailbox. So there's a primary mailbox, which is cached to the user's computer in cache mode. And then there is an archive mailbox. It's only available when you're online. It's not cached. Okay, so management becomes very, very simple because you're using the same EMC procedure. You're using the same shell commandlet to do your management. If you do have scripts, It simplifies those as well. It shares the same high availability and migration concepts as your primary mailbox. When you're sizing storage, it shares the same calculations for storage as your primary mailbox. So much, much simpler to deploy. So let's take a look at what this experience looks like for the user. So here's the user, this is my mailbox, and the archive opens up just like another node, just like a PST would down here, which says archive. I can basically copy and paste, I can cut and paste, or I can just drag and drop email between my archive and my primary mailbox. I can create inbox rules. This is my primary mailbox. I can drag and drop, put it in my archive. That's the user part of it. The user can also create inbox rules, and just like they move mail to any folder, they could move mail to their archive. Very transparent. Let's see what it looks like in Outlook. In Outlook web app. So here's your primary mailbox. Down here is your personal archive. And it's going to take a couple of seconds to expand because it's in the cloud. But there you go. You're accessing your email, residing in the cloud archive. So that, in a nutshell, is what the user is going to see. Now, what are the deployment scenarios for this? One is, of course, what you've seen in Office 365 or Exchange Online, is both the primary and the archive are in the cloud. The other one is what is known as a cross-premises or hybrid deployment, where you have some users with both their primary mailbox and archive locally on-premises. Then there are some users with both of them in the cloud. So you have a mix of those. Now, Exchange Online archiving is the third scenario down there, which is very different from the two above. You have your primary mailbox on-premises, and you have your archive in the cloud. And the user gets seamless access, like you just saw. We were accessing the mailbox from the cloud and primary on-premises. So primary on-prem, archive in cloud, it is a per-user setting. So you can have some users go one way, some users go another, depending on requirements. Unlimited quota. We were just talking about how much does it cost. So if you go and sign up on Exchange Online, and the URL is aka.ms/EO for Exchange Online. And scroll down all the way, there's a choice for Exchange Online, and it's $3 per user per month for unlimited, what we call bottomless archive. And that is pretty good in terms of the money you save for storage, restoring unlimited email. What's more than that is this seamless experience that you will have in terms of compliance, whether you're talking about retention policies or MRM, whether you're talking about putting users on hold, and we'll take a look at each of these scenarios, whether you're talking about performing an e-discovery across users residing on your primary or in-house Exchange server and the archive in the cloud, and we'll be able to do a discovery between the two and bring all that email into search results back into your discovery mailbox and then export that to a PST if you'd like. Auditing. So people, if you enable auditing, non-owner access is enabled by default, okay? Including any cloud admins, if they try to access your mailbox, which never happens, but should it happen, you can actually trace that, and that's incredible. As a security person, that makes me feel very, very comfortable. All management actions are performed on-premises, so that's huge. Now you don't have to go open a third tool, go into some third console, and do your management. And it does require hybrid configuration, Well, there's a whole session devoted to that. We'll talk about that. Let's take a look at the pieces of this puzzle. So on the left side, you have your on-premises Exchange environment where you have Exchange servers. Now, when you sign up for Office 365, or Exchange Online, rather, and Exchange Online Archiving, it creates a cloud-based Exchange organization for you. Okay? That's what happens when you sign up. And then you go and add all your domains, your registered email domains that you use for your email addresses. You install a DirSync server, or it could be sitting on an Exchange server also. And what that does is basically synchronizes your directory, all the recipient information that needs to go to Exchange Online is synchronized by it. In addition to that, you could, it's optional, it's not a requirement, but you could install an ADFS box, Active Directory Federation Services, and do identity federation for single sign-on. What that buys you is the ability for the user to just click on Outlook and not receive any additional authentication prompts. And that's a very seamless experience you want to have, your users to have. So highly recommended, but not a requirement. So you open up your on-premises management tools, either the EMC or the shell. You say, you know, enable an archive mailbox for my user. And it's a remote archive. So that configuration is written to your Active Directory. From there, the DirSync software that does the synchronization picks it up, synchronizes it to Exchange Online. And the user's archive is provisioned in the Exchange servers in Exchange Online. Then it writes that information back to through DirSync, and there's a write-back process that comes back into your Active Directory and says, hey, your cloud-based archive is now provisioned. So users have access to it. So that's the whole cycle. DirSync to do the synchronization for Active Directory, ADFS to do identity federation for single sign-on, recommended, highly recommended, but not a requirement. The downside is users are going to see a lot of authentication prompts if they don't have single sign-on, and we all know how annoying that can be. So now you do a get mailbox archive, and you're getting that information from your local Active Directory. Managing the archive. So it's the same operations that you do every day to create a mailbox, to basically enable a mailbox. You're doing the same thing with the archive. Create an archive. In fact, the commandlets are the same too. It's new mailbox. It's enable mailbox. If you look at it from the EMC, they look the same. You can move an on-premises archive. If you already have Exchange 2010, and if you've created an archive already for a user, you can move that now to the cloud seamlessly using the same infrastructure of move requests that Exchange 2010 has. And it gets moved to the cloud. Now it's an Exchange Online archive. So you can also offboard yourself or offboard a user from cloud back to your on-premises server by moving the cloud-based archive from Exchange Online back to your mailbox server. So great integration work there, and it's very, very seamless. These two operations are shell only. We'll take a look at those. You can disable the archive just like you disable a mailbox. When you disable the archive, it becomes disconnected, just like a disconnected mailbox. You can go and reconnect the user to that disconnected archive later if you wish, within a period of 30 days. And if you don't do that, in Exchange Online, after 30 days, that archive is deleted. The disconnected archive is gone. So the reconnection needs to happen within 30 days. So let's take a look at some of the admin tasks here. So I'm up here on a CAS server. Oh. Okay, switched. There we go. So I'm up here on a client access server. I have my EMC open. You see Exchange Online is added as an additional organization here, which is done by right-clicking here, going and saying add an Exchange Forest. Give it any name you want. and then from the drop-down, simply choose Exchange Online. It's going to pop up an authentication box. You're going to provide credentials for your cloud-based organization. That's what you receive when you set up your first account with Exchange Online. And once you do that, the Exchange Online node shows up, and that's your cloud-based org. So I'm going to go to my on-premises org. I'm going to go to recipient configuration and mailbox, and let's create a new mailbox. For a new user account. And let's say I'm going to use my external domain for the UPN. Give it a password. Move on. I'm not populating any of these right now, but what I wanted you to see is creating an archive. Now, if you're on premises, you can simply say create a local archive and select a mailbox database if you want, or let Exchange select it for you. Or if you want a cloud-based archive, which is what we're going to do, I'm going to browse, pick up the remote hosted organization. That is a remote domain created for your cloud-based org. And that should be the only one there. So create a remote hosted archive and click Next. And there we go. So exactly like you would create your on-premises mailbox and on-premises archive. They're very integrated together. So very similar experience. Now this is going to take some time. When I created this mailbox for David Beck, sorry about that. I should have. When I created this mailbox, let's go ahead and add the archive columns so that we can see what's going on with the archive. I'm going to select archive database and archive state. So I can see what's going on with my archive. Okay, so David Beck here, it says cloud-based archive is pending. So it takes time for Dersing to write to the cloud, for the cloud to do the provisioning, and for it to write back to flip the switch so that user can now go and access it. It could take a few hours to do this, or you could run a command, accelerate the process. Let's see if we can go ahead and quickly do that. On my Dersing server. And the command to do that is start online coexistence sync. Once I run that command, it's going to sync that with Exchange Online, and my provisioning is going to be a little bit accelerated. The write back is still going to be delayed, okay? But as long as it's provisioned in Exchange Online, I'm good. And I can go ahead and take a look at the user and set their status to active. So Active Directory users and computers. Let's go to users. Here's the user. Need to view advanced features so we can see the attributes. Or you can fire up etc/edit if you like etc/edit better than the built-in editor here. Okay. There we go. So Attribute Editor in Active Directory Users and Computers. I'm going to go to attribute called MS Exchange Archive. Which should be right on top here. Okay, there's an archive grid, archive database, and archive status. The archive status is not set. It sets when a write back occurs from Exchange Online to your org. Now, for the purpose of this demo, we're going to go and set this to 1. And once we do that, we go back to our client access server and hit refresh. And let's see if David Beck's cloud-based archive has been created. There we go. It says archive has been created. Now David Beck can go and access their primary and archive mailboxes. So that's the admin experience for creating. You can go through the same steps for enabling an archive for an existing mailbox that does not have an archive. You can do the same thing for disabling an archive and re-enabling a disabled archive. So it's pretty much tools that you are used to, and there is not a lot of learning to do. Now, how does client access work? So there are two clients that can access Exchange Online Archive. One is Outlook 2010 and 2007. 2007 is going to require some service pack or update, and the details are on the team blog as well as on in the documentation. So Outlook comes in. It connects to your client access server, connects to AutoDiscover to get the endpoints where my mailboxes are located, and if I have any archives. It gets that information back. It finds out its archive endpoint, which is Exchange Online. So now it knows it needs to connect to the CAS there and gets its archive mailbox. So it's got access to both the primary and the archive. The browser client, Outlook Web App, is even simpler. It just connects to the client access server. The client access server on premises actually does proxying and fetches your archive mailbox and renders it within that same browser window. So it's even simpler, and you get access to both your... So in both cases, you are pointing your clients to your on-premises CAS servers. So they don't even have to know that their archive is actually residing in the cloud. There's some extra animation. I don't know how it got in there. Okay. Now, so we know that this is all possible because of AutoDiscover. And if you want to diagnose how this works or why archive is not working, you can go and take a look at the XML that is returned by AutoDiscover. So in Outlook, the icon in the taskbar, just go and hit Control, right-click, and select Test Email Auto Configuration. And that pulls up the built-in utility to test AutoDiscover that's in Outlook 2010. And then you go on the uncheck Use Guest Smart and Secure Guest Smart, hit Test, and it will give you this XML. And if you scroll all the way down, it's going to show you it has an alternative mailbox. That's what an archive is. And it's going to say where that archive is located. So in here it says type archive, display name, legacy DN, and the server name, if you look at it, belongs to Exchange Online. So that's how you figure out if my archive is not showing, what do I do? Now, in addition to this, in Exchange 2010, I think Service Pack 1, there is also Service Pack 1 and later, there is a built-in command called test archive connectivity. Test-archive connectivity. Now, that's going to do the testing for you. It's going to connect to the online archive, whether it's on-premises or whether it's cloud-based, and it's going to tell you whether the user will be able to connect or not. So let's move on to setup. We already talked about how this works. So when you set up Exchange Online Archiving, you're basically going to go through all the steps required to set up a hybrid deployment, except for setting the connectors. the send and receive connectors, because you're not sending any email using SMTP to the Exchange Online. And you're not getting anything back by SMTP. Okay? So you don't need the connectors. So you're going to set up a hybrid server. You have your CAS and your hub, and then the optional Active Directory Federation Services server, should you choose to install that. Okay. Function of each, of course, is DirSync does the provisioning. The single sign-on is done by the optional ADFS. And then you've got access using Outlook Anywhere or OWA that is provided by the CAS. And then all the mailbox-related functionality is on the mailbox server, stuff like eDiscovery and MRM and so on. And we'll take a look at how some of that works. If you want to go into details of every step, we have a great session on Thursday, Configuring Hybrid Exchange the Easy Way. So make sure you attend that. So some of the steps. Register your domains in the Office 365 portal. So you sign up for an Office 365 account. There's a 30-day trial also, should you want to try it out. And set up your domains there. It's going to ask you to prove the domain ownership. And how is that done? That is done by creating a text record in the DNS for your registered domains in the external-facing DNS servers. Just like SPF records, right? They say, okay, only these IP addresses can send email. Similarly, this is a proof of your domain ownership by creating that text record. Configure the optional ADFS, configure DirSync, enable DirSync write-back, and there's detailed links to all these procedures in a single PDF. And then there is a prereq that you need to install for WCF. Mostly you will have an Exchange 2010 SP1 server on premises. That's the requirement. You cannot have Exchange 2000s and have an online archive for them. So they have to be on Exchange 2010 SP1 or later mailbox server. Configure the cloud auto-discover DNS record, so when clients come to your CAS server, they can be redirected to the cloud. Publish MRS proxy. This allows email to be transferred between your on-premises mailbox and the cloud-based archive. So that's the job of the MRS proxy. Configure a federation trust and an org relationship, and the hybrid configuration wizard will walk you through all these steps. And then implement retention policies or MRM policies to move mail from on-premises to the cloud after your predetermined period, like 2 years or whatever. So all these steps, if you have SP2, the hybrid configuration wizard is going to automate a good portion of that. So great tool on SP2. And the documentation, you see the URL down there, aka.ms/EOASetup, will give you all the detailed steps. If you are not on SP2 yet, if you're on Exchange 2010 SP1, there's a different set of steps because SP1 does not have the hybrid configuration wizard. If you're on SP2, there's a different set of steps because there's a lot of automation and validation built in that's performed by the hybrid configuration wizard. In addition to these tools, there is also the online web-based tool called Exchange Deployment Assistant, EDA. So it can walk you through how to create your EOA deployment. And on the screen, you will see some of the answers that you will need to provide to get there, to get that detailed checklist. Okay? And the URL for EDA, aka.ms/xdeploy. So these are all short URLs. So from provisioning and setup, let's move on to retention and moving and deleting messages. So messages are moved to the archive and deleted using retention policies. And what you're doing is basically managing the email lifecycle. Why do you need to do that? Moving to archive is understandable. But deleting messages We don't want our email to live on forever. Each organization has certain requirements. Some want to maintain their email for 3 years. Some want to do it for 5 years. Some want to do it for 7 years. Whatever your requirements are. But you do not want that email living on beyond that period because it exposes you to all kinds of risks. Plus, it results in extra storage for email that you don't really need. And if you leave it to users, they have a habit of collecting email, right? And you'll see, I heard 20 gig mailbox, 25 gigs. You know, we can accommodate very large mailboxes, but how many users really, really need access to email from 10 years ago, 7 years ago? So this allows you to delete your email. There's two types of policies within a retention policy. One is known as a move policy or a move tags. The other is delete policies. The delete policies allow you to either delete and allow recovery. That means they are still in the recoverable items folder. And user can go to Outlook and use recover deleted items to recover them back. Or you can choose to delete them permanently. That means no recovery after that, by the user or by the admin. So you can do things like move your mail in 2 years to the archive and delete permanently after 7 years, or whatever period you want to delete it at. The end user impact of this is, of course, it keeps the mailbox under quotas. It's a smaller mailbox. The archive is bigger. I'm caching less data to my desktop. I'm leaving more email out on the server or in the cloud, okay? The way you implement this is for the entire mailbox, you create default policies, known as default policy tags, and they can either move or delete the email. So what is the information you need to provide when creating these policies? So there's, like I said, two types of tags, move or delete. Each tag has a name and action, whether you want to move email to the archive or you want to delete the email. And the time period, how long do you want to move it after or how long do you want to delete it after? These are two types of policies. One is the admin enforcing a policy on the entire mailbox or specific folders known as default folders such as inbox, deleted items, junk mail, and so on. So for example, you may want a policy of entire mailbox, keep email for 2 years and then move it to the archive. Inbox, keep it for, let's say, 120 days and then move it to the archive. Deleted items, keep it for 30 days or 14 days. Junk mail, 7 days, and so on. So that's how you build your retention policy, by adding all these tags. A retention policy is nothing but a collection of retention tags that you can now apply to a mailbox user. And when you apply it, it applies to both the primary and the archive mailbox. So the delete policy that you apply, for instance, 7 years, delete all email, it's going to apply equally to your primary and your archive mailboxes. The other thing to remember, if you came from 2003, we get this question a lot, is in 2003, I could use LDAP filters to apply mailbox manager policies because they were part of recipient policies, right? Why isn't it so in 2007 and 2010? 2007 had managed folder policies. 2010 has retention policies. They are both applied to the user object. And this is done because we want to make it very, very deterministic. You should be able to look at a user object and say what policy it's applying to. Now, problem with LDAP filters applying these policies is a lot of admins were confused. Oh, a user is a member of this group, then he gets this policy. He's a member of this group, then he gets this policy. He's a member of this department, then he gets this policy. So which policy applies? There was this confusion. And when it comes to retention, you do not want any ambiguity at all. You want to be able to say, within this period, this email will be gone. So that's what the UI looks like in EMC. And it's basically a name, type of policy. The age, here it's 18, 25 days. It's actually an outdated screenshot, so looks like it has a wrong action on there, but your actions will be delete permanently, delete and allow recovery, or move to archive will be the actions you select. And then if you disable the tag, which is the option down there, it will not move or archive. So if you create a personal tag, which users can apply to their items like a folder or an email, it is never going to delete it or move it. Now, what does it look like in the client? In the Outlook client, if you go to a folder's properties, you will see the policy tab. Now, you will only see this if a retention policy has been applied to a user and the mailbox has been processed to provision the retention policies. Once this happens, users start seeing these policy tab in their Outlook client and also in OWA. They can apply different policies if you, the admin, provision them. Otherwise, you can just say, I don't want users touching anything. It's just me deciding what policies to apply. With personal tags, users can apply them to individual folders to change the behavior, to change the time period when the items are moved or when they're deleted. So the whole mailbox could be keep for 2 years. They go and apply to one folder called Do Not Delete, and that email never gets deleted or moved. On the right side, you see the UI and Outlook for applying to each item. So they can, now this is where the flexibility between managed folders and retention policies come in. Managed folders were more folder-based. Retention policies are more granular than that. You can apply it down to the item level. So the folder could be 2 years, but the user can tag one individual email and retain it for as long as the tag says it should be retained for. So very flexible for the users. Now they can emulate the managed folder functionality if they want by applying the tag to a folder, to a custom folder if they want. In addition to these tags, you can also provision some more tags that can be used in your organization, but they are not part of the user's policy. Users can then go to the Exchange Control Panel and add these tags. For instance, delete in 1 day, things like newsletters that lose all relevance after 1 day. So it's the kind of email you don't want hanging around for too long. So you can provision some extra tags. Key takeaways from this is retention policy applies to a mailbox user. It does not apply to the primary mailbox only or to the archive only. And we get this a lot, is why doesn't the archive have, or can I apply a different policy to my archive mailbox? No, you can't, because I apply it to a mailbox user. The other confusion that I want everybody to remove from their minds, and again, we've answered that question a lot, can I apply both move and delete policies to the same item? Yes, you can. An item can have both move and delete policies because they're independent of each other. They're different functions. Now, the other question that I also get is, what if an item has a move policy and a delete policy for the same time period? Let's say 2 months. What happens first? Does it get deleted first? Does it get moved first? And my first response is, does it matter whether it moves first or delete? But if you really should know, it gets deleted, because that makes more sense. Okay. The delete policy that is stamped on items, if you apply a policy to an item, when you move that item to a different folder, it's going to retain that delete policy. And if you looked at the Outlook UI back there, it actually shows in Outlook and now in Outlook Web App also when the item is going to be deleted or expired. And the precedence rule is you have a mailbox policy known as a DPT or default policy tag. You may have a folder policy. You may have a subfolder policy and a subfolder policy for creative users who can nest into many, many subfolders. And then they may have applied a different policy to the item itself. So the answer is, the policy that's closest to the item takes precedence. So individual item, subfolder, subfolder. In that order, the first policy is the closest to the user. That's the one that applies. Now, what makes this moving and deleting occur is a process called the MRM mailbox assistance, which is actually called manage folder assistant in the product, but we're not talking manage folders anymore, so I like to call it MRM assistant. So this is a process that runs in the background. It came in Exchange 2007, and it processed manage folders. And back then, it was a scheduled process. So if you forgot to schedule it, even if you applied the policies, guess what? None of your mail is deleting or moving to a managed folder. So when we moved to 2010, in RTM, we included a default schedule. So even if you forgot to put in a schedule, your process would. And it is daily 1 a.m. to 6 a.m. It would still work. But our mailboxes keep on growing, and this mailbox assistance, if you scheduled it between certain hours, may not have enough time to process all the mailboxes. So in SP1, 2010 SP1, we made it a throttled process. That means it is on all the time, except it's throttled. It can't consume all the resources. Okay. So what can you specify? Well, in general, I've seen people do not need to do anything at all. It just works. But if you should know, there's two parameters on there. There is what is known as a work cycle. A work cycle simply specifies how frequently to process each mailbox. And if I specify, and what is the default, a 1 day, then all the mailboxes should be processed in that work cycle. So that's a work cycle. There's a work cycle checkpoint. So that has to be lower than your work cycle. If your work cycle is 1 day, your checkpoint is, let's say, 6 hours or 12 hours. It's going to stop at 12 hours. It's going to look at, oh, which mailboxes have I not processed in a long time? Are there any new mailboxes added? It's going to add them to the queue. The mailboxes that have never been processed or has been a delay in processing, it's going to move them to the top of the queue. So they have a better chance of getting processed. Now, in on-prem default, like it says, 1 day, and you set it using set mailbox server, not set mailbox. That's an error on that slide. It's set mailbox server. If you move to Exchange Online Archiving and Office 365, the cycle is 7 days. So if your email is supposed to delete today, chances are it may not be processed for a few days. Next, we move on to the concept of retention hold. And the common scenario for this is user goes out of office for an extended period, a month, 2 months. They're not getting their email. They're not deleting their email. Chances are your retention policies may delete email before they've had a chance to see them. So we say, okay, you're leaving. I'm going to put your mailbox on retention hold. And that simply says suspend processing of retention policy for this mailbox. Do not delete anything. Okay? When the user comes back, you can remove the hold, and the processing will resume again. You can actually do it in advance by specifying a start date and an end date for retention hold. So that's, now this is different from the other type of hold that we're going to talk about, which is litigation hold or legal hold. So command is up there, but you can also do it from EMC in user properties. It's on the mailbox settings, messaging records management, and you're able to set retention hold from there. You can also do it through ECP, the web-based console. So what happens when you set a cloud-based organization, whether you're in hybrid mode or whether you're using Exchange Online Archiving and only hosting cloud-based archives? You're going to have to sync your on-premises retention policies to your cloud-based organization. Now, what happens if you do not do that? The move is processed on-premises, so that's going to go through okay. Okay? Move in 2 years, it gets moved on to Exchange Online Archiving, and from there, it's never going to get deleted because Exchange Online Archiving, or EOA, didn't have your policies. So one of the first steps after you deploy EOA is set up your policies, synchronize them. We've got scripts, export retention tags.ps1, that creates a nice little XML file, and then you can import those to the cloud. Very seamless, and you can run it from the same command prompt. Next is, so we saw retention hole. Now this, you know, times people get confused between these two types of hole and what is the functionality of each. So the second type of hole, let me go back. The first type of hole, the retention hole, what it's doing is preventing email from being destroyed, right? Because retention policies are not really retention policies. They are destruction policies. They're saying when to destroy email, okay? At least that's how I like to think about them, destruction policies. So this is stopping the destruction policy, the retention hole. Now, when I want to preserve email, when I have reasonable doubt that somebody's going to go through litigation, I'm going to have a lawsuit, then I can set those users on legal hold or litigation hold. And what does this do? This basically, very transparently, the user doesn't have to know, puts their mailbox on hold indefinitely. And while they're on hold, and they don't know, they're going to try and delete email. And it's going to go away. They're going to go to recover deleted items and delete it from there. Some users are that smart, right? And when they delete it from there, it's going to just hide it from them. It's going to move it to the purges folder in recoverable items store. And we're going to continue holding on to that email, that message, or that mailbox item until the hold is removed. Now, this message hidden from the user is actually indexed. When you're running an e-discovery search, that message is going to show up. So it basically, very transparently, without the user finding out, you can put them on hold. The other thing that legal hold does is it creates versions of items. So a user who doesn't know or maybe knows that they're on hold, they go ahead and try to modify an item while they're on hold. They haven't deleted the item, it's in their inbox, but they've received that item, they double click on that item, they open it, they try to edit it. There are some item properties that are editable, right? And then they save the message again. This thing creates, litigation hold creates a copy of that message right before they save the modified copy. And that copy is stored in a versions folder, also hidden from the user, in the recoverable items store. Okay? And this recoverable items store, or what was known as dumpster before, we do not call it the dumpster anymore because it has a lot of valuable compliance-related data. So let's not call it dumpster. It's recoverable items store. So the user doesn't see it. This recoverable items store is part of the mailbox. When you move the mailbox, it moves with it. That means discovery is always possible. All your versions, all your deleted items will continue to live on until the hold is removed. So you can set the hold using a commandlet. You can also do it from the ECP. And on the screen, what you see is an e-discovery search where you see user, Arno? Has items in the recoverable items folder, in their deletions folder. And those have been recovered by eDiscovery, by performing a discovery search using multi-mailbox search. Now, when you're setting the user on retention or on litigation hold, if you're using Outlook 2010, you can choose to alert the user. Some organizations choose to do that. The user can't do anything, but it may help to inform the user. So this is the configuration in ECP for setting the user on hold. So you can do it from EMC, you can do it from ECP, the web-based console, and you can do it from the commandlet using set mailbox, litigation hold enabled, $true. Now this is what the alert looks like to the user. It's shown in Outlook 2010 in their backstage area. And you can provide an optional URL that the user can click to get more information about your hold policies in general or about that particular case that this guy is subject to. So depending on your organization's policies, you can choose to provide that information. And this is only visible in Outlook 2010 and later. Now, when is this visible? It's not visible as soon as you set litigation hold. The MRM assistant has to process the mailbox. That's when this thing starts showing up. So maybe after you put the user on litigation hold, you may want to start the managed folder assistant against that user's mailbox or any number of users that you have that you're enabling litigation hold on. Then there's a concept of rolling hold. And this simply says, you know what? I understand retention policies. They delete email. I understand litigation hold, but litigation hold holds my email indefinitely. I don't want that. I want a rolling hold where my email is held for at least 7 years. Okay? You should not be able to delete email before 7 years. What do I do? Well, you use the single item recovery feature to make this scenario possible in Exchange 2010 and set your deleted item retention period for that amount of time. Okay? And then you enable single item recovery for that mailbox. Now, for 7 years at least, which starts after the user deletes the email. Okay? It sits in the recoverable item store for 7 years. Now, the user can go again and delete it from recover deleted items, and it's going to be hidden from the user, and it's going to be flushed out after 7 years. So that meets your requirement of, I want to hold on to this email for at least 7 years. Now, related to this is, I want to hold my email for 7 years only, no less, no more. So this is not going to be able to meet your requirement. If that's your hard requirement, it's only going to guarantee that you have your email for at least 7 years after the user deletes it or after the retention policy deletes it. And it's set on per mailbox. Now, when you have Exchange Online Archiving, all these holds, they impact both your primary and your archive in the cloud. Or if you have an on-premises archive, it'll impact that as well. How does that happen? The same DIR sync process. You put in a hold, DIR sync syncs it to the cloud. Now the cloud knows it's on hold. And you can manually kick off the replication if you want, and it happens sooner. So where do you manage legal hold? You manage it on-premises. That's where your mailbox resides. Now, items in the cloud-based archive or in your on-premises archive, they have their own recoverable item store. So if somebody gets deleted from the archive, it's going to be sitting in the recoverable item store of the archive. Okay? There's also a default policy that will take items from your primary mailbox and push it to the recoverable items in the primary mailbox and push it to the recoverable items of your archive. So your primary mailbox, including the recoverable items, stays small. You can go and modify that policy. You can remove it if you would like. But that is the default policy that ships with Exchange 2010. Next, we come on to auditing and reporting for things. And there's two types of audits that Exchange 2010 ships with that, again, works very seamlessly with Exchange Online Archiving. So first thing is admin changes. What changes did I make to my configuration, including user configuration, commandlets that I run, or EMC, or ECP? Any changes that I make, I need them audited. It's very important for a lot of organizations. Things like, was litigation hold ever removed from this mailbox? You want to keep a record of all this. Did anybody run an e-discovery search on my mailboxes? You want to be able to keep a record. The other type of audit is what is known as mailbox auditing. Who besides the owner accessed my mailbox and did what with it? Did they delete an item? Did they move an item to a different folder? Did they permanently delete an item? All these events, I may not need to capture forever for everybody. I may want to do it for some users. So non-owner access, you probably want to capture it for everybody, right? But owner access is not really required. You don't want to find out every time a user read their email or deleted their own email, except if that user is under investigation for something. At that point of time, you may say, you know what, I want to audit everything he deletes. So for owners also, you can go and set up auditing on that mailbox and say, audit deletions, audit moves of item to a different folder, and so on. Now, when you go to audit the configuration audit, it's done using set admin audit config commandlet. And when you enable this, any operations that are performed against both your on-premises Exchange organization and your cloud-based organization, both will be audited. And these audit events are logged in an on-premises arbitration mailbox. So it's a single mailbox that holds all these, and they cannot be deleted by the admin or the user. They'll stay there for 90 days, and the only that's a default period. And the only way to get rid of them is to change that 90-day period to zero. And even that event will be audited if your auditing is on. So you will know who changed my auditing settings. Results can be searched, so you can do it in ECP. You can also do it using commandlets. There is new admin audit log search, which is an asynchronous thing. It can search and send you an email. Or search admin audit log. It can throw up information on your screen. It's a synchronous search. Next comes mailbox audit. Captures all non-owner access. It's configured per user. So if you use set mailbox, there is options to configure delegate access. There is options to configure owner access. There is options to configure administrator access. And in this case, administrator does not mean the Exchange admin on premises. That is still considered a delegate. Because by default, administrators do not have full access permissions to a mailbox. In fact, they have an explicit deny to access other people's mailboxes, users' mailboxes. So any admin access is also considered delegate access. So what is administrator access? Administrator access is if anybody in Exchange Online Service, the admins there, try to access your mailbox data, which never happens, but you will be able to track that. That makes me feel really, really good when I'm using a cloud-based service. So these are the different auditing options. If you go to ECP, you have options to run reports for non-owner mailbox access. For users who are on hold, I can run reports for role membership for my RBAC roles, and so on. And finally, there is discovery, or e-discovery, the sort of the reason why we go through all this trouble of keeping this email for X number of years, is we want to be able to perform discovery on them. It can happen whether you're served for, you know, you're going through a lawsuit. It can happen, HR may come to you and say, hey, we want email for this person. Look for these keywords in this email. Or just give me all their email from a start date to an end date. So you should be able to perform these searches. Now, this is a distributed search. If you are on Exchange 2010, this will search Exchange 2010 mailboxes only. If you're using Exchange Online Archiving, it's going to search mailboxes primary as well as your cloud-based archive. And it's going to suck out that email from your cloud-based archive and copy them to a discovery mailbox on premises. That's a special type of mailbox. It is disabled by default. It has a very large quota, and it's used for discovery. So you dump all that email from your cloud archive to the discovery mailbox, and then you can do whatever with it. You can give access to HR to that discovery mailbox. You can give access to third-party lawyers or internal lawyers, or you can use export commandlet to export that discovery mailbox and hand out a PST, because law firms love PSTs. Okay, so that's discovery. Now, by default, discovery searches both primary and archive. If you use the cmdlet, you could exclude the archive if you wanted. Ability to view keyword statistics. So you specify keywords, it'll give you each keyword, how many hits did it have of email. So that helps you fine-tune your query, search query, and come up with queries that is not going to get your whole mailbox door. Ability to annotate items. So once the items are copied to a discovery mailbox, the person who's reviewing those items can pick each item, put in notes in there, and then you can go and search by these notes or additional annotations and so on. Key thing to remember here is, by default, nobody has permissions to do e-discovery. Not even the administrator, not even the organization administrator. So you have to add authorized users to the discovery management role group. That's a RBAC or role-based access control group called discovery management. So you add, let's say, your internal lawyers or your HR department, whoever has the need and needs to be authorized to perform an e-discovery search and to be able to put mailboxes on legal hold. You would add them to your discovery management role group. Once you do that, these guys now have the ability to perform discovery searches across both your primary and cloud-based archive, or if you have an on-premises archive, they can do that as well. So that's it. Let's take a quick look at e-discovery. So what we're going to do is we're going to log into a mailbox that has permissions to do e-discovery, and we're going to go to the Exchange Control Panel. Okay, they said use a passphrase, not a password, so that's what you get. Okay, let's go to this CAS server. Now, key to remember is when you're doing a discovery across your on-premises primary and the cloud-based archive, all those searches need to be performed from your on-primary server. So there is no cloud interaction at all. So I'm just going to go to my, once this thing comes up. Okay, that thing works. Let's try connecting to the other server, which doesn't work yet. Maybe we can just work off this server. Okay, let's go to my client access server here, which is excch.ch.01. This is my on-premises. And I'm going to ECP. And before I do that, let me go and find out who has permissions to do a discovery. Sorry about this. This phone does not want to be silent. Okay. Give it a second to do the SSL negotiations. Meanwhile, if you have any questions, we will have a few minutes to do that. Yes?
I have a user with a 24 gig PST file.
Okay. Okay.
Very
good question, and we have a few minutes, so we can talk about it. I can't show you. I can probably show you at the booth if you come down later. So if you want to migrate PSTs that you already have, how do you do it? Well, there is the import command that will, the import new mailbox import request that will import PSTs into your primary mailbox or on-premises archive. Now, if you have a cloud-based archive, you can import it into your primary mailbox, and then you can have retention policies to push that onto the cloud-based archive. Now, we made a tool called PST Capture. What PST Capture does is searches your organization, your computers, for PST files. And once it finds them, it allows you to take those PST files, copy to a share on the server, and then inject those PST files to appropriate users' primary mailboxes and archives. Now, if the user has primary on-premise and archive also on-premises, it'll work. If your user has both in the cloud, it will work. It currently does not work for the EOA scenario where you have your primary on-prem and your archive in the cloud. So for that, you basically put your import it into your primary and let the managed folder assistant do the work of pushing it all to the cloud. Let's go ahead and go to, I'm in my manage my organization. I go to mail control. And you see, I do not have the permission to do e-discovery. I don't even see the tab. If I go to the shell, I'm not even going to see the commandlets to do e-discovery because I'm not authorized to do so. But because I'm an admin, I can go and add myself to the discovery management role group. So let's see how that's done. Under roles and auditing, administrator roles, we've got discovery management. It says who are members of discovery management. So let's double click on that. And let's go ahead and add. Oh, these are roles. We need to add people. So here are people. Let's go add and add myself to it. Actually, it's right here. Okay, so now that I've added myself to the discovery management group, I can basically go and say save. If I can see the control in this limited screen resolution, that is. Okay, now I need to log off and log back in for that new token to take effect, and I should be able to see that. So let's try and quickly see that. Meanwhile, any other questions while we're doing this? Yes. With Exchange Online, so if you had your primary mailbox coming into your on-premises and EOA is sitting in the cloud, your archive, then all the journaling is going to occur on-premises because your archive is not receiving any SMTP email coming in or going out. You're sending it from your primary mailbox. You're receiving it in your primary mailbox. So any journaling you do there is the journaling that you have. Okay. Okay. Yes. Yes. With archive, if you want to do discovery, he brought up a very good point, actually. So if you want to be able to do discovery on these archives and on primary mailboxes using e-discovery, you can't do it on disconnected mailboxes. You can't do it on mailboxes that don't exist. So you would have to simply disable the mailbox and just keep it for as long as you need to perform discovery. I am not sure. If you send me an email, I could get you an answer on that before saying either way. Yes?
If you currently have on-premise archiving turned on, we have it turned on for everyone. Some of those archives are fairly large, and we're moving to online. Is there a way to see those outside of just moving them through the internet? I mean, is there a way to...
So is there anything else besides Managed Folder Assistant, having to push it from your primary to the archive? Is there any other way to seed the archive? Well, if you had an on-premises archive, you can use the import commandlet, new mailbox import request, only on-premises. If you had PST capture utility, you could use that as well. But PST capture will all not work to seed cloud-based archive when the primary is on-premises. which is what we're talking about, the Exchange Online Archive. Now, if you had both primary and archive in the cloud, then PST Capture will still be able to push your PSTs.
Okay, I got another question.
Yes. Yes.
Do you need to have that in addition to Office 365?
So, Office 365, you are not using your Exchange features. You're using the service, and you're paying for that separately. But you are going to be using, if you're using retention policies and you're using personal tags, that's a feature that requires enterprise scales. Excuse me. So let's quickly finish this up and perform a discovery here. So now I see my discovery tab because I'm a member of discovery management. And I can run a new search, specify a keyword, let's say patents and Contoso. Include items that cannot be searched. These are items that are not able to be indexed, maybe because they have a file attachment that we cannot index or some other error. Messages to or from specific addresses, a date range. I'm going to search everything. Mailboxes to search. So in this case, for my demo purposes, I only have my own mailbox to show. So that is what I'm going to search. And then I need to specify a name for the search. So I'm going to say Contoso demo. I can either estimate the search results or I can copy the search results to the discovery mailbox. In this case, I'm going to copy them to the discovery mailbox. Enable deduplication will basically make single copies of the email, but the logs will have all the details of the deduplication done. Enable full logging, we'll have detailed logging available. And then I select a discovery mailbox. In this case, I selected discovery 2. And I'm going to save this search object. I'm also going to say, send me an email when the search is done. Now, when I create the search object is saved. In the background, it's going to go search the primary mailbox. It's going to search my cloud-based archive mailbox. It's going to go get that copied to my discovery mailbox. And then I can go and access my discovery mailbox and get the results from there. Doesn't look like we have enough time to show you completion of the results.
It works.
Yes, it does. But what I wanted to show you was it works across your primary on-prem and in the cloud. So any more questions? I can take them outside, and I can take them at the booth. Please make sure you provide feedback if you have good things to say and learn something from the session and some additional resources. You can find me later at the Exchange booth. Yes. Yes.
And they go into that. The default rights on that, can they do anything with that? Like, let's say you give someone rights, and let's say they leave the company 3 months later. How do you monitor what they're doing with that?
The access audit logging.
Okay. Oh, so you go back and audit.
Yeah. Every discovery search will be audited. So you can go and pull up who performed discovery, what mailboxes, what is the query that they used. And what did they do with it? Did they copy them to a discovery mailbox? You will have all those details. Yes. Thank you.